From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two highly regarded poets discuss their over 20-year marriage and the effects of illness and depression on their writing and their relationship. Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon will talk with us and read from their new books. Also, remember Jack Sheldon from the Merv Griffin Show band? He played with the band for 18 years, but that's not the reason we invited him on the show. When you hear his latest record, I think you'll understand why. And John Leonard reviews a new novel whose cast of characters includes Freud, Henry James, and Edith Wharton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel says it's waiting for a PLO statement that could pave the way for mutual recognition of the sworn enemies. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Reports from Tunis say the PLO is trying to work out a declaration that will satisfy both its own executive committee and Israel. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres today said most of the 33 clauses of the PLO National Covenant call directly or indirectly for the destruction of Israel and must be changed.
We expect the PLO to issue a general commitment that all those items or articles which calls for the destruction of Israel will become invalid.
Peres said Israel is also demanding that the PLO renounce terrorism and violence as a means to achieve goals. The PLO leadership is expected to meet tomorrow in Tunis to approve the changes. An Israeli recognition would most likely be followed by the United States resuming its own dialogue with the PLO. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin set off a new round of political conflict today with the announcement that he's temporarily suspending two opponents in his administration. Yeltsin sought to remove Vice President Alexander Rutskoy and Deputy Prime Minister Vladimir Shumeko from power while they're being investigated on allegations of corruption. Yeltsin has the authority to suspend Shumeko, but opponents challenged his right to remove Rutskoy, who's an elected official. Rutskoy, a popular veteran of the Afghan War, was elected on the same ticket as Yeltsin, but he's since become an outspoken opponent. The president of the Central African Republic has freed the country's prisoners, including ex-president Jean-Bedel Bokassa. Cindy Shiner of African News Service reports from Abidjan.
President André Kolingba freed self-declared emperor and president for life Jean-Bedel Bokassa years before the end of his sentence. Bokassa has been jailed since 1987 for embezzlement and murder. He ruled the former French colony for 14 years and earned the reputation as a ruthless dictator. Bokassa allegedly engaged in torture and cannibalism and was linked to the deaths of 100 schoolchildren. He amassed a huge fortune before he was deposed by the French in 1979. Nevertheless, he still has allies. Hundreds of youths cheered him in the capital, Bangui, on Wednesday. The 72-year-old Bokassa is barred from entering politics in the Central African Republic, which recently held presidential elections. President Kolingba finished fourth, and a runoff is scheduled for September 12th to end a dozen years of military rule. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Abidjan.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to close at 3,645. This is NPR News. The White House denied today that it's planning to pay for its health care reform plan solely by cutting back on spending for Medicare and Medicaid. The statement came after the Washington Post reported today that the administration believes it can redirect as much as $240 billion from Medicare and Medicaid over the next 5 years. The White House acknowledged that it's counting on saving tens of billions of dollars in cuts from those programs, but it said savings will come in all areas of health spending, public and private. A federal district judge in California has ruled that the military ban on homosexuality is unconstitutional. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The ruling came in a case filed by attorney Mel Dahl, who was discharged from the Navy on grounds of homosexuality in 1982. In ordering the Navy to reinstate Dahl, federal judge Milton Schwartz found that the military's ban on homosexuals was grounded in prejudice. He ruled that if heterosexual sailors are able to tolerate the presence of gays as long as they don't know who they are, that shows the policy stems from heterosexuals' attitudes, not homosexuals' behavior. This ruling applies to the ban on gays that was in effect before the so-called don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue policy put in place by President Clinton this summer. This is the second time this year that the ban has been struck down. In January, another federal judge found the policy violated the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection. The government is appealing that decision. I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
There was another small drop in business at the nation's factories last month. The National Association of Purchasing Management said its index for the month fell by 0.2 to 49.3. A reading below 50 generally indicates that the economy is contracting, but the report wasn't as bad as many economists had been predicting. An association spokesman said the decline represented a slight increase in unemployment and in business inventories. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few years ago, poet Donald Hall began a memoir called Life Work. The book was to be about his passion for writing and reading, and about what work meant to his parents and grandparents who labored on the family farm. He felt that he was writing his book in defiance of death. A couple of years before he started the memoir, he lost half of his colon to cancer. The recurrence he lived in fear of was diagnosed midway through his work on the memoir. The cancer had metastasized to his liver. Doctors gave him a 1 in 3 chance of living more than 5 years. Hall's memoir ends just as his chemotherapy is about to begin. He writes how close he is to his wife of 22 years, Jane Kenyon. She's also a highly regarded poet, and she too has a new book called Constance. We invited Hall and Kenyon to join us to read from their books and to discuss the impact of illness on their work and their marriage. First, Donald Hall will read an excerpt of his memoir, Life Work.
If all goes well, as it were, I will by inches recover the morning globe, the coffee, work on poems and work on prose, walking the dog, love with Jane, and the continual or recurrent dread, exacerbated every 3 months by checking my CEA, that a black cell multiplies. It's a common condition for millions of people. Old ones dropping off and new ones entering the mode. The cancer club, the death watch. Heaven knows, at moments of anxiety, magic thinking knows no let or hindrance. They are reading everything I write on this yellow pad. I'll take it, I'll take it. The nature of this book alters. Shall I change the title from Life Work to Work and Death? Box office, he said, sneering. Oh, let me return to my theme. I've worked all this pre-operation week, but not on life work. Absorbedness has helped, and absorbedness is incomplete. This morning, as I write this medical report for life work, I find that work remains the matter, not only in defiance of death, but in plain sight of it. It absorbs me to write these pages. It absorbs me more nearly than anything else has done for the past week or 10 days. Writing about cancer allows me to transcend my cancer by the syntax or rhetoric of dread and suffering. If work is no antidote to death, nor a denial of it, death is a powerful stimulus to work. Get done what you can. When I'm sick after my operation, not only sore but bonkers, the way anesthesia leaves you, I will write nothing, or at least nothing well. But I can fill the days before the operation with work on life work. And I'm determined to write about something besides dying. There's so much I haven't touched on, like my grandfather's daily work, my grandmother Kate's labors, women's work, and ideas from sociologists of work. I have a list of topics to keep me busy. The alternative is tears, appropriate enough, but miserable. I keep thinking of Jane, of my mother, of my children and grandchildren. I'm not exactly afraid, but I'm surely sad. Talking with a friend today, I said that I was surprised not to feel more frightened. I was surprised to feel pity for Jane more than pity for myself. Not that I'm without self-pity. Quickly, I called myself egotistical for thinking that my death was the worst thing that could happen to Jane. Then both of us said at the same time, yes, but it is the worst thing that could happen to Jane.
Donald Hall, thank you for reading that. Has the meaning of work changed for you since the cancer?
I think it's intensified. It's actually this patch of my life is one of the best patches yet. I think it's more serious, more intense. I'm not scared all the time or panicky. I mean, that by this time, I feel this fears and panics rather rarely. But goodness knows the preciousness of the hour is greater still. And the preciousness of the hour in doing what I love the most. One of the things I love the most, it's one of the more consistent things over 50 years, is the struggle with language that I spoke of.
How is your health now?
Right now I feel wonderful, and my tests lately are just fine. I'm perfectly aware that this could happen, that this could go away quickly, and that the chances are not very good. But right now I'm fine. There's no trace of cancer in me right now that anything can measure.
Let me just paraphrase something that you wrote in at the end of the reading that you gave at the beginning of our talk. You were saying that you were thinking that your death could be the worst thing that ever happened to your wife, Jane. Let me introduce your wife, Jane Kenyon, the wonderful poet who's with us as well. And Jane, can I ask you what your reaction was when you read that passage?
Well, I had to agree with it. It really is the worst thing that could happen to me. We're extremely close, both as human beings and as writers. We share so many of the same joys and difficulties. We're extremely close. We live and work in the same building 24 hours a day, and we're very much in each other's pockets. So it really would be devastating for me to lose my pal.
I'd like to ask you to read a poem, and this is a poem about your husband after surgery. And the poem is called Chrysanthemums.
Right. This one is about the first round we had before he had metastasis to the liver. So, Chrysanthemums. The doctor averted his eyes while the diagnosis fell on us, as though the picture of the girl hiding from her dog had suddenly fallen off the wall. We were speechless all the way home. The light seemed strange. A weekend of fear and purging. Determined to work, he packed his dictaphone, a stack of letters, and a roll of stamps. At last, the day of scalpels, blood, and gauze arrived. Eyes closed, I lay on his tightly made bed, waiting. From the hallway, I heard an old man whose nurse was helping him to walk. That Howard Johnson's, it's nothing but the same thing over and over again. That's right, it's nothing special. Late in the afternoon, when slanting sun betrayed a wad of dust under the bedside stand, I heard the sound of casters and footsteps slowing down. The attendants asked me to leave the room while they moved him onto the bed, and the door remained closed for a long time. Evening came. While he dozed fitfully, still stupefied by anesthetics, I tried to read, my feet propped on the rails of the bed. Odette's chrysanthemums were revealed to me, ranks of them in the house where Swan, jealousy constricting his heart, made late-night calls. And while I read, pausing again and again to look at him, the smell of chrysanthemums sent by friends wavered from the sill, mixing with the smells of drastic occasions and disinfected sheets.
That's an excerpt of Jane Kenyon's poem, Chrysanthemums, and the poem is included in her new collection of poetry, Constance. Jane, how long after the surgery did you actually write that poem?
I guess it was, the surgery was in the autumn. It was in September. It would have been in the months following, in that winter following.
When you write a poem that's about Don, or Don, when you write a poem that has to do with Jane, do you show it to each other right away?
Not right away, but we always work together on poems.
Even the poems about each other?
Oh, yes, yes. We also work with other friends. Each of us has our own committee, you might say, and we work very closely with other friends. But we do indeed work on each other's poems, and there are times when we just, I simply have to say to Don, well, I can't tell you about this because I just can't get far enough away from it to have much judgment about it.
Jane, at what point in the development of Chrysanthemums did you show the poem to Don?
Well, it was many months after I started it, and I felt uncomfortable about this poem because I was revealing very personal things in it, and I wasn't sure how Don would feel about it. And I remember prefacing my showing this poem to him by saying, you may feel that this is too personal and that I didn't have a right to reveal these things. It's best to be careful about hurting people in this way.
If I wasn't hurt at all, but I mean, I suppose I'm glad to be asked.
And then, Don, did you work on that poem at all?
I can't remember. I mean, almost always I have something to say. It's famous in our house that Jane will show me a poem and I'll say, this is going to be good. And Jane will say, going to be, eh? You know, I mean, I love her poems. But I'm always telling her to take out the word and there and take the comma out here. Take this line from the end of one line and put it at the beginning of the next. And she tells me the same things, of course. Endlessly. And we often do what the other says, but not always. I don't remember what in particular I said about this, but the fact that it was about me and my illness would not keep me from having ideas about the sound of it, the style of it, the poetry of it. I mean, at first, I read it, it's a poem about me, kabump, I'm struck by it, and then by that fact, and then I start hearing the cadences and looking at the images, and if I see anything that doesn't sound quite right to me, I'll tell her. That's what we're useful for to each other in this particular way.
Is there ever any friction between the two of you of who has ownership over a certain experience that you both shared, you know, and who has more of the right to write about it?
Well, sometimes when something particularly piquant happens to us, one of us will say, jump ball.
Or dibs. I remember being with a bunch of poets years and years ago back at Ann Arbor. Jane was one of them. And somebody said something terrific, you know, a good phrase, just adjective, a noun or something. And everybody started yelling, dibs, dibs, on that. I don't think that we've really had any friction on this. We have written about the same thing, but we write differently enough. We can do that. It's all right. I mean, we wrote poems at about the same time about the Gulf War. This is not personal experience in this case, but it was really kind of amusing. Hers, in this particular case, is 10 times better than mine. And this is not modesty. It's just objective fact. But mine is so absolutely a man's poem. Hers is so absolutely a woman's poem. It's just comical.
It's a joke, really.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of lines that for you epitomize the male?
You have it in there,
perspective?
Don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, mine is a poem which begins with the act of tearing up an old nightgown for rags, an old flannel nightgown. And then the poem in the second stanza moves to making supper while listening to NPR, to the news, all things considered, and thinking of the war. So that the tearing up of the nightgown is like the dismemberment of the body. And the imaginative leap is from the tearing up of the nightgown to the torture and suffering of people caught in this awful, awful war. And it's inward, and it's grief-stricken, and it's... So my poem is personal and domestic in a way, and Don's is utterly public and political and brings in layers of history. It's noisy and ebullient, and they just couldn't be more different.
Yeah. This is an unfair comparison, and I'm the one who made it. mine is historical and outward and very sarcastic, very ironic. It talks about if Lord Gilgamesh cannot... Gilgamesh was Saddam Hussein, as it were. I mean, he was king of the same territory. And then the coalition of Lord Agamemnon and Napoleon and all sorts of people with missiles and, it's full of history, allusion, and irony. And it's very outward and kind of bombastic. It makes fun of itself. But, that's the contrast. That's enough of it.
My guests are poets Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon. They have been married for over 20 years, and they each have new books. Donald Hall's new book is a memoir called Life Work. Jane Kenyon's new book is a collection of poems called Constance. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guests are poets and husband and wife, Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon. You've both written about battles with depression. And I'm wondering if you think it makes you more sensitive to each other's mood swings, or if it causes certain problems if you're not on the same mood swing schedule, so to speak.
We try to arrange so that one person, so that we're not both down or both up at the same time. I think that we try to arrange for one of us to be manic and the other depressed at the same time, so that it's like Plato's ball, or is it Plato or Socrates, who first imagined the human being as a sphere. If you put the manic and the depressive together, press them together into a ball, you'd have a whole human being. And I've often thought that if someone took the two of us and shook us up in a brown paper bag and turned us out, there would really be one complete human being.
we have had moments when we were both pretty low, which are very hard moments, because when you're so low, you can't help the other person. But that hasn't happened very often, as Jane says. I think that there is a mechanism in us that tries to, or that is able to compensate when the other is inevitably lower. When I think I had my most recent illness, Jane had been rather low, and she just rose to the challenge totally and was totally nurturing and... then when I was better, she sagged down again, and I was able to help a little. I noticed that. Maybe I'm inaccurate, but it seems something
like
that happened.
No, I did make a special effort to pull myself together there.
It's the time when you think you cannot possibly make an effort, that you're making every effort you can, and circumstances require something from you, and you have it that you didn't think you had.
Do you think that your depressions have become more pronounced in the face of illness, or do you think that it's easier to transcend depressions when you're facing something as, monumental as cancer?
Oh, it's hard to answer that. I mean, my serious depressions began when I was in my early 30s. They began in the year after my father died dreadfully of cancer. And my really incapacitating depressions began in my early 30s. And I've been on medication ever since.
Jane, I'm thinking here of a poem that you wrote called Having It Out with Melancholy, in which you're basically addressing melancholy.
Yes.
And you say to it, "You taught me to exist without gratitude. You ruined my manners toward God. Quote, we're here simply to wait for death. The pleasures of earth are overrated." How often do you find yourself thinking that now?
Well, it happens. It happens despite everybody's best efforts and all the fancy pharmaceutical footwork that could be imagined. I began this poem not when I was at the absolute nadir, but close to it. I thought to myself, sometime I must write a poem in which I reveal the experience of depression so that people who have never experienced such awful agony, inward agony, so that those people might understand a little more what it's like and stop telling us to shape up, go buy a hat, go take a nice walk. I really meant to speak for all of us who have been incapacitated by our emotional life. And even though I was too low when I conceived of the poem, I was too low to actually begin working on it. I did conceive of the poem when I was in fact of a very, very depressed state.
Don, in writing about T.S. Eliot, you were quoting Eliot as saying, no honest poet can ever feel quite sure of the permanent value of what he has written. He may have wasted his time and messed up his life for nothing.
Yep.
Do you both feel confident of the value of your work?
No. Not at all. It is a matter of mood. I mean, in the morning, when I've been working, if I wander out and see Jane some mornings, I may say, mocking myself, I am great or I am immeasurably great. And another morning, I will characterize myself in terms of an obscenity, meaning I'm no good at all, I never was. And I feel it strongly then, and part of my mind also knows, tomorrow you'll feel different. You don't know. I don't know. There are times when I get depressed about my work and I think nothing is ever any good, more seriously than the mood thing I was talking about, when I really feel very depressed about everything I've spent my life on. And there are other times when I feel, not so much confident about it, just happy with it, happy with the endeavor, with the continuing endeavor. That does not translate into anything like knowledge that my work will endure. I had to give up on that a long time ago. When I was, say, 15 years old, I thought I wanted to be, a great poet. I wanted to be on the top of the mountain. And I thought that at some point I would find out whether I got there or not. Well, when I was in my 20s, I began to realize that you never know. And when I asked Eliot the question, do you know you're good? Eliot was the Nobel Prize winner. Everybody thought he was the greatest poet since Dante, practically. I mean, it was a moment of Eliot worship. And when I asked him that, I had the suspicion that he would say he didn't know. And that's exactly what he said, as you quoted him.
Jane, what about you?
Well, the conviction that you may be writing something worth having written comes and goes. But the thing that does not come and go, the thing that remains constant, I think, for both of us, is the desire to really make art and to embody the truth and to make something beautiful and to make something that really makes people's lives better. It gives them deeper understanding of their own existence and great joy because of beauty. That desire never goes, no matter how depressed I am about what I've been writing lately or not writing. I still have that desire, and I know in Don, too, it's very, very strong.
Jane Kenyon and Donald Hall. Hall's new memoir, Life Work, is published by Beacon. Kenyon's new collection of poems, Constance, is published by Grey Wolf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon. He's worked with everyone from Lenny Bruce to Merv Griffin. He's played with Chet Baker, Art Pepper, Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman, Jimmy Giuffre, Frank Sinatra, and Tony Bennett. If you remember Sheldon from his clowning with the Merv Griffin Band, you'll be very surprised by the emotional depth and vulnerability on his latest record. Also, John Leonard reviews a new novel by Carol de Chelis Hill, set in Vienna at the turn of the century. The women of Vienna are being murdered, and the suspects include Freud, Henry James, and Edith Wharton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The Bosnian peace talks in Geneva broke down today. The president of Croatia blames new demands by Bosnia's Muslim government. The BBC's Paul Reynolds reports from Geneva.
It was the Croatian president, Franjo Tudjman, who announced that the talks had ended. He shrugged his shoulders to reporters and said, "There's been nothing." He then explained that the Bosnian government, or the Muslims as he called them, had put forward new demands. But in the opinion of the participants and the co-chairman, there was no purpose in continuing the conference. The Muslims, he said, had told the conference they did not want to accept the results of genocide, a moral but in view of the reality and irrational argument, according to the president. One of the Bosnian government delegation, Fikret Abdic, then let it be known that he had favoured a further compromise by his side, but he had not been successful. The sudden outcome was something of a surprise, because only an hour or so earlier, a Bosnian government spokesman had said that progress was being made.
Paul Reynolds in Geneva. The White House has endorsed the Pentagon's new five-year plan unveiled today, but Congress still has to approve it. The proposal would close more military bases, which some lawmakers may oppose. The strategy would also make deep cuts in the Army and Air Force. President Clinton will finish his health care reforms in about 10 days, Press Secretary D.D. Myers said today. The president unveils his plan to Congress September 22nd. Meanwhile, White House officials today denied reports that the administration will pay for health reform with cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. Retired Ohio auto worker and accused Nazi war criminal John Demjanjuk will be allowed to return to the United States if and when Israeli authorities decide to release him from prison. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The U.S. Justice Department has been trying to bar Demjanjuk's return ever since July, when Israel's Supreme Court cleared him of charges that he was the Treblinka death camp guard, Ivan the Terrible. The U.S. stripped Demjanjuk's citizenship before deporting him to Israel in 1986, but a federal appeals court in Cincinnati ruled yesterday that he should be returned to this country, while his future status is litigated. The Justice Department considered taking the matter before the U.S. Supreme Court, but today, Attorney General Janet Reno said her office will not appeal. However, she said,
"We will continue to do everything possible to uphold the court orders denaturalizing and deporting Mr. Demjanjuk."
Israel's Supreme Court is due to rule tomorrow on whether Demjanjuk should face a new trial. Nazi hunters claim he committed war crimes at another concentration camp. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Jordan and Israel may sign an agreement soon. Jordan's information minister says it's not a peace treaty, but a declaration of principles with Israel. He says the accord would be a step toward a peace settlement. On Wall Street, stocks close mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 6 points. This is NPR News. A consumer group released a booklet today identifying 10 hidden hazards of everyday life. The Coalition for Consumer Health and Safety says tragedies could be avoided if people keep these hazards in mind. The list includes failure to use seatbelts in cars, falls and burns caused by baby walkers, poisoning from improperly cooked foods, and the effects of secondhand tobacco smoke. Also cited were the failure to wear bicycle helmets and the risks of drinking too much alcohol. Vice President Al Gore and Russia's prime minister are meeting in Washington today. They're working on a space and missile technology agreement for joint efforts in space shuttle and space station programs. Russia's political turmoil deepened today following a presidential decree dismissing Vice President Alexander Rutskoy and Deputy Prime Minister Vladimir Shumeika. The two were leading figures in a corruption controversy, as NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin's decree suspends the two men temporarily, pending the results of investigations into corruption. corruption allegations against them. It's the latest move in the protracted struggle between Yeltsin and his anti-reform opponents in the Soviet-era parliament. Both sides are stung by today's decree. Rutskoy is Yeltsin's running mate turned opposition rival, and Shoemaker is one of his closest aides. When the corruption mudslinging started in earnest last spring, Rutskoy fingered Shoemaker for mishandling millions of state dollars. Lately, Rutskoy was attacked by Yeltsin investigators for allegedly channeling state funds into a Swiss bank account. While Yeltsin can dismiss Shoemaker, who's an appointed official, there's likely to be a heated dispute over whether he has the constitutional power to dismiss his elected vice president. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
French Prime Minister Edouard Balladur wants to change the country's constitution to make it harder for immigrants to enter the country. The government has passed a number of anti-immigration laws, but some have been challenged in the courts. An amendment would need a three-fifths vote by both chambers. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz musician Jack Sheldon has played trumpet, sung, and cracked jokes in many different settings. He's been a featured soloist with Sinatra, Bennett, Goodman, Basie, and Gillespie. His bandmates have included Chet Baker, Art Pepper, and Zoot Sims. Sheldon has played on the soundtracks of nearly four dozen films, including The Pawnbroker, The Pink Panther, and White Men Can't Jump. And he recorded the very first rendition of The Shadow of Your Smile for the film The Sandpiper. Then there's the TV themes he played on for The Munsters and Peter Gunn. And for 18 years, Sheldon was resident comedian in the band for The Merv Griffin Show. Now he leads a big band in Southern California. Jack Sheldon's most recent recording, On My Own, on the Concord Jazz label, presents him in a surprisingly intimate and emotionally exposed setting. The album features a series of duets with pianist Ross Tompkins.
This love of mine goes on and on. Though life is empty since you have gone, you're always on my mind. Though out of sight, it's lonely through the day, but all the night I cry my heart out. It will surely break, since nothing matters, just let it break. I ask the sun and the moon, the stars that shine, what's to become of it? This love of mine.
Jack Sheldon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
I don't know why I had this image of you, but I always thought of you as somebody who relied a lot on humor in their singing and music. And there's something so emotionally naked about some of the songs on your new record that really surprised me. I really love the singing and the playing on it. Is the choice of material or the kind of singing that you're doing a relatively recent development with you? The kind
well,
of
I've been trying. I
doing.
Think I'm singing better now. I'm studying mm-hmm. singing, and
oh.
So I just can do it better. But I've been doing it all my life, and it's more naked. I think more. I like that, emotionally naked. That's good. But I guess I'm just developing into where I can do more personal, you know, stuff and. Better pitch and just things I've been working on, and studying it too helps.
Well, that's interesting. Tell me what you're getting from learning how to sing. I mean, taking formal lessons.
Well, just real simple stuff, but, you know, to have a lot of foundation, get a lot of air and use your diaphragm, and I notice now when I, if I'm having trouble with a note, it's really because I don't have the foundation there to, you know, get a lot of air in my stomach and my diaphragm and to open my mouth wide. You just learn real simple things that you'd think you'd do, but you don't really, and then practice the pitch and the articulation. It's just... things like the trumpet with the, you know, hitting every note precisely in pitch, and it's just doing things, you know, to have somebody keep telling you. It's good to take lessons and study like that, because then you have, you do what you do, and then somebody can criticize you, and in a nice way. They're real nice to me, and they're real encouraging.
Was there another change that happened to you besides taking lessons? Did something happen emotionally that left you more open to this kind of material?
Well, I got sober 8 years ago, and I don't drink or take drugs or do anything like that, and I think that left me teachable. Before that, I thought I was really cool, and I knew everything. So, and I didn't want to take lessons. I thought I was better than the teachers, you know, and I really just didn't know what I was doing. And then when I got sober, I found out there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know, and that people didn't use me, not because they didn't like me or anything, because I couldn't produce what they wanted. Now I'm trying to get to be able to do anything any composer might want.
When you were playing in the 1950s, bop was the thing, and very few of the instrumentalists sang. Did you sing back then, and were you self-conscious about singing at all?
Yeah, I was always self-conscious about singing. I wanted to sing, but it's so personal, singing. And I started singing with Benny Goodman's band, and that was about 1958. And I wrote a song, and Benny let me sing. He was the first band leader that would ever let me sing. Stan Kenton wouldn't let me sing, though, because he always was afraid I would say something too off-color, which I probably would have.
Did you have a reputation for doing that?
Yes. I worked with Lenny Bruce, and I was trying to kind of emulate him at the time.
What kind of work did you do with Lenny Bruce? You were in the band playing at the club or something?
Yeah, in burlesque, I worked with Lenny Bruce. We worked with his wife, Honey, and Joe Maney, and Philly Joe Jones, and Kenny Drew, and Leroy Vinegar. We had quite a real good band there. And we played burlesque at a place called Duffy's in Los Angeles. And Lenny was the comic, and we did all kind of, he would write stuff, and we'd act out. We did The Man with the Golden Arm. And
oh, really? Like your own version of that?
Yeah, a burlesque version.
Well, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was funny, I think. I think it ended up where the guy flushed the dope down the toilet, and then Lenny said, there's only one thing to do is smoke the toilet. It doesn't sound so funny now. You really had to be there, I guess.
Trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon is my guest. His latest album is called On My Own. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon is my guest. It's interesting to me, you know, you're taking lessons now in singing and trumpet, and I'm glad for the fact that you're not becoming overly obsessive in your performance on technique. I mean, you still, like, play trumpet solos in which there's kind of clear ringing notes, but also these, like, wonderful, like, smudged, arpeggiated kind of figures. You know what I mean? I'd hate for you to give that up just because you're learning good technique. Yeah.
No, yeah, I'm going to have that smudge for life, I guess. My teacher says that. He says, I don't want to ruin your style or anything, but I don't think there's much chance of that. I would like to get as clean as I can, but the smudge is there, I think. It's in my bones.
Why don't I play another track from your latest album, On My Own? And I thought I'd play some of I Can't Get Started, because it kind of shows off everything, your trumpet playing, your singing, and it shows both, like, the emotionalism of your singing and also some of the humor in it, too.
Okay, thanks. ¶¶
flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted, still I can't get started with you. Around the golf course I'm under par, and Benny Goodman made me a star. I had a house, a show place. Now she got that and I got no place, and I also can't get started with you. You're so supreme.
That's Jack Sheldon on trumpet and vocals from his new album, On My Own. There's a really interesting documentary about the trumpeter Chet Baker that you were featured in. You were one of the people interviewed about Baker. And I remember you saying that, and I should mention that like you, Chet Baker played trumpet and sang. And you were very funny about him. You talked a little bit about how frustrating it was that he never, you were always in a room rehearsing and practicing, and he never had a practice or anything. He always just had the sound, and he always looked so great.
I hear Harry James never had to practice, but I have to practice all the time. Doc Severinsen practices all the time. But, I was singing back there with Chetty when we were little kids, come to think of it. We were both singing, and we'd sing together, and we grew up together, and... we would sing. We had a little quartet. We'd go around and play in little bars for $2 or anything we'd get. We just would drive up. The bass player, Hirsch Hamel, had a Pierce Arrow, and we'd have the bass in there. And, it was a 12-cylinder old car with a place for a chauffeur and everything.
How old were you then?
Oh, I was about 14, 15. I was about 15. No, 16, I guess.
And how did you...
Because I was in Florida when I was 14. I was 16, and Chetty was about, about 18 or 19.
How did you meet?
I think at a place called the Showtime, which was on Sepulveda and Ventura Boulevard. And it was a jam session on Monday nights, and all the guys that were on the road would come in there. I got to play with Art Blakey in there, and Stan Kenton, and a bunch of people. Maynard Ferguson would come in there, and Chetty and I would always just sit in. To me, it was, the glittering night of stars of jazz, and I was just thrilled to be there.
Now, how did you get to the West Coast from Florida, where you grew up?
Well, my aunt came out here first from Florida, and she was a swimming teacher. Crystal Scarborough was her name, and she taught babies how to swim. And then we moved out here, and my mother started teaching swimming, and I taught swimming, too. And we got a pool on Hollywood Boulevard. My mother taught all the movie stars' kids how to swim. Paul Newman and Lee Remick, every movie star at the time. Nat Cole. I taught Natalie and Kelly Cole how to swim.
Really?
And used to have Kelly... in the pool with me, and Nat Cole would be walking around the pool smoking cigarettes. He was a chain smoker. And I'd have Kelly sing, "When the blue of the night meets the gold of the day," Bing Crosby's theme song, and Nat would go, ha, ha, ha. But it was slightly humorous. But I taught a lot of kids. I taught all of Paul Newman's kids. In fact, one of his daughters used to bite me on the ankle when I'd be talking to Joanne Woodward.
How old were you when you started working professionally when you started playing with other bands?
I was 12 in Jacksonville, Florida. And I had just started playing the trumpet, and I started working with Gene Brandt's band at the Washington Hotel there. Everybody was gone in the war. And so I started working, and then I came to California and started college at 16. I started to go to USC, and then I switched over to City College because they had such a good music department. So I went to college there for a couple of years, and then I joined the Air Force, and then I got out of the Air Force, and I worked a lot with Mexican bands. I worked at Million Dollar Theater downtown Los Angeles, all Mexican shows. And then I went in the... I joined Stan Kenton, and went to New York and played at Birdland with Stan Kenton. And Chet Baker was already there in New York, and he was already acting real wild. He played opposite Miles Davis, and this threw him off. Before he went to New York, he would smoke grass sometimes, but then he got all involved in heroin and everything else in New York, and then, he got really messed up then, and he never really was the same after that, because he was a great kid, and then he got too wild, but he always was a great genius of a trumpet player.
I want to ask you something else about your sound. Do you think that there's a connection between the way you sing and the way you play trumpet?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Just, all the wrong things I do on the trumpet, I do with the voice, too. But I'm trying to eliminate that now and get... I want my pitch to be better and my preciseness. Now, that's what I'm getting with my lessons. You know, in jazz, we can hit a note and go... kind of come up to it, and in classical music you have to be precisely on the pitch singing and playing the trumpet, and this is something that I never really watched when I always had pretty good pitch, but I would come up to notes or go down to them, and in the classical music my teacher's always stopping me and say, no, right on the pitch, hit the note on the pitch, and do anytime I make a mistake too, he has me go back and start again.
Do you ever worry that you'll lose some of the jazz flavor or rhythm or intonation of your music?
I don't think so. No, I think it's really just helped me and made me much better. I don't think you can get too good. It just helps, really. I found it that way. My teacher's always saying, I don't want to take anything away from you, but... I think it just helps, if anything. It just makes you more efficient and competent.
Jack Sheldon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm so flattered you had me on. It's a thrill. I love your show, and it's a great show, and thank you very much.
Jack Sheldon's latest album is called On My Own. It's on Concord Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on the evolving Israeli PLO plan?
Well, we'll be hearing from Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the latest diplomacy. Also, I'll be talking with two experts on Middle East politics about exactly what's in and what's not in this agreement. Also today, Noah Adams has a story about the pilots who fly the planes that carry the banners over the beach. It turns out to be a rather hazardous business. We'll be hearing about one such business in Ocean City, Maryland. And we'll be hearing from a psychologist and author of a new book who believes that birds, whom we usually think of as being automatons driven by instinct, are a lot smarter than we think.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Several turn-of-the-century luminaries from Europe and America make appearances in Carol DeCellis Hill's new novel, Henry James's Midnight Song. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
In turn-of-the-century Vienna, that capital city of alienation, the body of a dead woman is discovered in the study of Dr. Sigmund Freud. Even though this body later disappears, the police stay put. All over Vienna, young women vanish from the streets, after which parts of them show up, detached toes and severed heads, at the bottoms of garbage cans, in the tops of trees, or iced in the Danube. And the hysterically anti-Semitic Viennese accuse Jews like Freud of ritual murder. A worried Emperor Franz Joseph sends for the Austrian-born Paris detective Maurice Leblanc, who is Jewish himself, and so smart that he reads Baudelaire in bed each night. Freud, his dippy wife Martha, and his sister-in-law Minna, with whom he is having a secret affair, are all suspects. So is Henry James, who thought he was consulting Freud on behalf of his sick sister Alice, but is actually riddled with guilt because he strangled a cat. Suspicious, too, is Edith Wharton, who travels with Henry James, is having her own secret affair with a London journalist, resents Freud's theory of childhood seduction because it probably happened to her, and actually burgles his office. And so is Carl Jung a suspect, whose unprofessional behavior with a female patient suggests that there must be an archetype for cad. We also meet the Zionist Theodor Herzl, back from the Dreyfus trial, and the physicist Albert Einstein, relativizing promiscuously, and the playwright Arthur Schnitzler, who doesn't like anybody, and the critic Karl Kraus, who is worried that Hugo von Hofmannsthal will turn into another Heinrich Heine, a Moses who strikes the rock of the German language with his rod, and all that spurts forth is eau de cologne. Not to mention the symphonic composer Mahler and the secessionist painter Klimt and Wittgenstein's sister. All of these people, when they aren't reading Baudelaire and Nietzsche, dream a lot about horses and falcons and swans, about Jesus and Pascal and Hansel and Gretel. None of them would tell the truth even if he or she knew it. As well as blood, there is sex in the strudel and a dead dog. I've made all this sound jaunty, and to a surprising extent it is. What Carol Hill doesn't know for a fact from the literature and the scholarship, she will make up with nerve and verve and something like mimetic genius, a slapstick of great minds, as seen through the eyes of a very Jamesian 17-year-old American girl, whose sister wants to be a character in a novel, either Isabel Archer or Anna Karenina, and whose aunt is an Engels-reading suffragette, and whose cousin, a tiger-eyed Viennese countess, vamps our Paris detective. But slapstick can shift to epiphany, a set-piece Sunday in the park with Edith and Siggy, and then suddenly become nightmare. Because history, Hill is telling us in this splendid oratorio and circus of a novel, is something more and something other than a literary situation. Opening its mouth to sing, Europe strangles. The mushrooms are poisonous. That blonde head in the frozen Danube is more than a Klimt painting. Under the statues of Goethe and Schiller, assassins scuttle. At the masked ball, in the labyrinth, there are anarchists, androgynes, misogynists, and thugs. All these people, whether they know it or not, are also dreaming of Hitler.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Henry James's Midnight Song by Carol de Chelis Hill. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlees. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from grants provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Medicine, the Law, and Bioethics. We'll talk with bioethicist George Annis. He says doctors' fears of being sued for malpractice often distort their medical judgments. Too often, the law, rather than medicine or philosophy, is setting the agenda for American bioethics. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.